overhead projector, and they'd put these old songs up on the wall. They'd flash the lyrics up there, and everybody would sing the old songs together. I think for a lot of churches, singing of hymns doesn't amount to much more than that. It's just kind of fun to make a bunch of noise together. I'm going to suggest that none of that is a really good reason for singing hymns, particularly if we're assembled to worship the Lord our God. We're not the audience. We're the performers. He's the audience. And I don't think it really matters much to Him one way or the other whether we're having fun or not. It's not about whether we're having fun. It's not about whether we're enjoying ourselves. Second suggestion is that the reason we have hymns is to express doctrine. And I agree that that is a component in good hymnody. But if that's the only reason we have hymns, don't we have a lot more efficient ways of getting doctrine across than sort of singing around doctrine in hymns? Isn't preaching a more effective way of communicating doctrine? Isn't a creed a more effective? Okay, Baptists don't have creeds, they have confessions, I know. What's the difference between a creed and a confession? The answer is, there isn't one. Yeah. Excuse me? Yeah, the spelling. Isn't a confession a lot more precise and accurate way of communicating doctrine than a hymn? And if really, if the purpose of our hymns is to express correct doctrine, then why are we singing so many that are either doctrinally incorrect or completely vacuous? So it seems to me that it doesn't work to say that the purpose of our hymnody is to express doctrine. It's got to be more than that. Here's what I'm going to suggest. Hymns are for. And by the way, as you know, hymnody, music, is not optional for the church. You know, Ephesians 5. We are told not to be drunk with wine, to stop being drunk with wine, actually, which assumes something about the congregation to which he was writing. Stop being drunk with wine, in which is dissipation, but rather be filled en pneumati. Now, there's a lot of discussion about what it means to be filled in the Spirit, filled with the Spirit, filled by the Spirit, what it means for the Spirit to fill you or for you to be filled by something that the Spirit puts into you. And we're not going to get into all of that. But Paul follows that command with a series of participles that explain what it looks like if you are filled with the Spirit. And one of the manifestations of being filled with the Spirit is speaking to one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing and making melody in your hearts to the Lord, which, by the way, authorizes not only vocal music, but also instrumental music. That expression that we translate making melody, that participle psalantes, is strumming. So if we can't have air instruments in church, at least we can have guitars. Ooh. Should we have guitars in church? Of course we should. Now, there's a difference between the guitar of an Andreas Segovia and the guitar of a Peter Townsend. You don't even know who Peter Townsend is, do you? Some of you don't even know who Andreas Segovia is, or was. There's a difference between how you use the guitar or over how you use the guitar. But should we have them in church? Of course. Of course. In fact, I'm going to suggest that there is no class or category of instrument that is prohibited in the worship of God. Look at the 150th Psalm. Every category of instrument you can think of is named there. Stringed instruments, wind instruments, percussion instruments, they're all there. I think they're all perfectly authorized for use in our worship. Having said that, how we use them is an issue. Bottom line, music isn't an option for us. Singing and praying isn't an option for us. It's commanded. It's a direct manifestation of the filling of the Holy Spirit. So why? Why is God so concerned that we sing, that we make melody, that we give thanks in our hearts to the Lord? I think the reason is because hymnody does something that no same way and no doctrinal statement can do as well, and that is to reach the affections. What hymnody does inside of us one hand, take a doctrine and to put a doctrine in view. Without a good doctrine, there isn't good hymnody. So good doctrine is at the core, but inside of us, and it takes the right kind of feeling and connects it with that doctrine. A good hymn is going to do at least one thing, and a very good hymn is going to do a second thing. Okay? A good hymn is going to provide us with a vehicle through which we can express a right response to the doctrine that we have encountered. In other words, it's going to give us a way to say what we feel when we couldn't find ourselves. Now, guys, we all understand what this is about, right? Those of us who are married, we have our wives, and we actually do feel deeply about them, but our wives rarely know that because we don't know how to say it, right? I love you. And says, really? And we say, I love you, man. By the you send Hallmark when you care enough to send the very best, right? And we hope that's gonna, or you know, we get some other little card or something. In effect, what I'm doing, what I'm saying facetiously here about husbands expressing their affection for their wives is the problem that many of us face when we encounter the really astonishing truths of who our God is and what He is true. Far beyond the ability to express ourselves. And what a good hymn is going to do is to give us the language to say what we wish we could think to say on our own. And so when we sing the hymn, the doctrine is squarely in front of us. It's uppermost in our minds. But the hymn is the response to the doctrine, and we are putting ourselves into it. Either we will or we can't. And by the way, both of those are appropriate responses to good hymns. You ever encounter a hymn that you just can't sing because you can't get through it? I could point you to probably half dozen of those in the hymnal. That I start singing, and I love to sing, but I get about halfway through, and I stop because I'm choked. Because it says it so well. Okay. A good hymn will do that. In fact, a good hymn has to do that. If it doesn't do that, it's not a good hymn. A really good hymn goes one step further. Now, like a good hymn, a really good hymn has a doctrine squarely in view. It states the doctrine. But it does more than simply to express what you feel. It may state a doctrine that you've never considered. It may state a doctrine concerning which you have no feeling because you've never really thought of it before. A really good hymn can reach inside of you and bring out of you something that you've never felt before. It can teach you how to feel. It can evoke a feeling and then shape that feeling so that it trains you how to respond rightly to God and His Word. By the way, this evening we're going to be talking a little bit about why that's so important, that we get that right response. Because, as you know, people respond differently to the same truths. It's possible for a person to encounter a truth and to be overwhelmed by that truth. It's possible for another person to encounter the same truth and to be left unmoved. It's possible for one person to encounter a truth and to see in it something profound. It's possible for a different person to encounter the same truth and to turn it into something trivial. And an awful lot of what gets sung in our churches takes deep, profound truths about God and trivializes them. And I'm not talking about CCM here. You know what? CCM doesn't even enter my mental world. It's so far away from me, I don't worry about CCM. I'm worried about what goes on close to home, which, as it happens, turns out to be CCM more and more often. But that's not what I'm concerned with here. I'm concerned with stuff that's coming out of our own publishing houses. And we look at it and we say, this wouldn't even make a good detergent commercial. And we're singing it to God. Who do we think we're kidding? So what does a good hymn have to do? If this is what hymnody is for, what's it going to have to do in order to accomplish all of this? And let me suggest that a good hymn is going to have to move through at least three steps, and I'm going to call them that, three steps, if it's going to accomplish what we've just said it needs to accomplish. First, and you're going to think this is so basic, you will think I'm insulting your intelligence here. First, it has to say something. It has to say something. Okay, in my mind, that rules out all of the 7-Eleven choruses that don't really say anything at all. But more than that, when I assert that a hymn has to say something, I mean by that it has to say something meaningful. It has to be more than just a cliche. It is possible, in fact, it has happened repeatedly, that you can take a profound spiritual truth and reduce it to a cliche that simply gets repeated in one generation. And what happens in the next generation is that what they consider is not the truth, but the cliche. And they begin writing songs to the cliche rather than to the truth. Now, I'm not going to try to illustrate this. We're only playing good hymn. I'm not going to play bad hymn here. Oh, I'm so tempted. But I'm not going to do it. I'm going to restrain myself. Over and over again, we sing cliches that are really meaningless. And here's the problem with a cliche. A cliche doesn't really say anything. It simply repeats a stereotype. And it confirms us in a stereotyped response that doesn't match reality. And if our stereotyped response doesn't really match reality, then when it gets challenged by reality, our stereotyped response is going to crumble. And we will end up feeling as if we've been lied to. And there are an awful lot of people who have grown up in fundamentalist churches who feel exactly that way about the Christianity they've been taught. It's been a cliche, Christianity. Not just cliche hymnody, cliche Christianity. And it bumps up against the struggles of real life, and it's overwhelmed. And so they think either somebody else must have an answer within Christianity and they leave fundamentalism, or else they conclude Christianity doesn't have an answer and they leave the faith. It has to say something. And what it says has to be more than a cliche. Second, it has to say something true. Not just say something meaningful, but say something true. It's possible to utter a statement that is meaningful, but false. We talked about this a little bit last night when I recited a couple of lines from Christian songs and asked you to identify the theology. And it's amazing to me how often in our churches we are asked to sing aberrant theology. God our Father, Christ our brother, all who live in love are thine. When's the last time you sang that in your church? Joyful, joyful, we adore thee. When's the last time you had somebody in your church play it? It's liberalism. The man who wrote it was an avowed theological liberal who hated and opposed fundamentalism. He was seeking to put into a text liberal sensibilities. Why do we sing that? It's false. It's phony. It's heresy. So it's possible to evaluate the truth of a hymn at the propositional doctrinal level. And I'd be much more happy if we were simply willing to do that. But it's also possible for a hymn to be true or false at a deeper level. Because remember, what we've said is this. The purpose of a hymn is not simply to repeat doctrine, but to respond to doctrine. And the response can either fit the doctrine and match the doctrine, or else it can contradict the doctrine. I'll give you an example. My hands are so dry that I find it difficult to turn the pages of my Bible. Let me read for you just a bit of a poem here. Whither shall I go from thy spirit? Or whither shall I flee from thy presence? If I ascend up into heaven, thou art there. If I make my bed in Sheol, behold, thou art there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there shall thy hand lead me, and thy right hand shall hold me. If I say, surely the darkness shall cover me, even the night shall be light about me. Yea, the darkness hideth not from thee, but the night shineth as the day. The darkness and the night are both alike to thee. What's the doctrine that is in view? God's omnipresence. And how does the writer develop this notion of the omnipresence of God? Wherever I go, God is there. If I go into Sheol, God is there. If I go into heaven, God is there. Uttermost parts of the sea, God is there. I hide in the dark, God is there. What kind of a response is this hymn writer trying to get from us? What response is he expressing? There's humility, awe, comfort, because anywhere I go, God is able to help me. And one more, fear, because there's nowhere I can go where God can't get to me. Are those ordinate responses to the omnipresence of God? Well, it's the book of Psalms. Which one of us is going to say that's inordinate, right? It's there in the Bible. Of course that's ordinate. Here's a little rhyme that comes from my friend Dissidens. God is here, God is there. God, you know, is everywhere. He's up your nose, between your toes. He dwells within your garden hose. What doctrine is in view here? God's omnipresence. How does it lead you, this rhyme, how does it lead you to respond to God's omnipresence? Yeah, with a sneer. It makes a joke of God's omnipresence. It makes a mock of God's omnipresence. Now, we're not going to discuss right now how it does that. There are specific devices, specific tools that the verse uses in order to get you to respond this way rather than that way. But the point of the verse is to set God's omnipresence before you in such a way that you smirk. Now, when you consider this rhyme, God is here, God is there, God you know is everywhere, He's up your nose, between your toes, He dwells within your garden hose. Is this true? Well, we could evaluate it at the propositional level. God is here, is that true? God is there, is that true? God, you know, is everywhere. Is that true? He's up your nose. Is that true? Anybody here care to deny it? That somehow my sinus cavities represent space in which God's omnipresence is not allowed? At the doctrinal level, at the propositional level, yes, it's true. Between your toes? Well, you know what? We're beginning to go, I don't want to say so, but yeah. He dwells within your garden hose. Oh, man. You're thinking, I can't say that's true, but I can't deny it either. So is the rhyme true? And the answer is, however true it may be at the propositional level, this isn't just about repeating doctrine. It's about a correct response to the doctrine. And aesthetic truth, unlike propositional truth, is all about the response. See, truth is correspondence. A proposition is true when it corresponds to, when the statement, the proposition, corresponds to the reality at which it is looking. At the aesthetic level, at the artistic level, a response is true, an affection is true, only when it corresponds to the object toward which it is directed. And I'm going to suggest that the response of humor, smirk, comedy, does not correspond to the omnipresence of God. So, at the most profound level, this little rhyme lies. It's as phony as a $3 bill. Incidentally, footnote, to anticipate maybe some of the things that Scott is going to be talking about, this is why music is so important in hymnody. I'm not talking about music, I'm talking about texts. But it is possible to have a text that is spot on doctrinally. And because of the response that the music evokes, it becomes false and bogus and phony. So, it's the response. A hymn has to say something. Something meaningful, not a cliche. A hymn has to say something true, and true means not only propositionally true, but effectively ordinate. It has to evoke and state ordinate responses, ordinate affections. That is to say, the correct response for the doctrine that is under view. And then third step, a hymn has to somehow open a window on the truth. In other words, it has to allow us to view this truth from a different perspective than we would otherwise see it. It has to allow us to see what we have not seen before and would not see if it were not for the perspective of this artist who has glimpsed it in this way and has somehow, through the vehicle of his art, brought us to a point where we can see it through his eyes. In other words, a hymn, like any work of art, is a work of imagination. Now, when I say imagination, that does not mean that it's something we're just making up. But the fact of the matter is that when it comes to spiritual realities, which we cannot see, they are intangible, when it comes to spiritual realities, we have to be able to imagine them. And this is, by the way, what I'm going to talk about in the service this evening. I want to talk about imagining God. Because if we don't imagine God, we can't know God. And if we imagine God wrongly, we become idolaters. So, that's where I'm headed tonight. Right now, I'm just going to say that this hymn that we're singing has to open a window on the truth. It has to give us a perspective, a standing point, from which we're able to view the truth and to see it in a light in a way that we never would otherwise have seen it. If we didn't have the 139th Psalm, would we understand God's omnipresence exactly as we do? The answer is no, we wouldn't. Because David has grasped something about God's omnipresence that no other biblical writer quite perceives. And when we enter into the mind of David in the 139th Psalm, somehow through David's eyes, we are able to see God's omnipresence in the same way. Now, granted, the 139th Psalm is inspired. The songs in our hymnal are not inspired, unless they're written by Gaither, who insisted they were. But even as merely human vehicles, the function that they are performing is or ought to be the same function. They ought to be doing the same thing. And now I want to get into the final question here, and that's, how do they do it? If a hymn is going to work this way, how does it work? Or, more specifically, since we're dealing with the texts, why do we use poetry? Why don't we just take a bunch of prose, let's say a doctrinal statement, and just set it to music? Actually, sometimes we do. It's common in some churches to sing the Credo. Credo meaning I believe, and it's the Apostles' Creed. Okay, which is a doctrinal statement. It's a short doctrinal statement. It can be sung. Interestingly enough, it's a doctrinal statement that is as close to poetry as it is to prose. But why poetry? Why poetry at all? Why use an art to do what we're doing here? And the answer is because art seizes the imagination, poetry seizes the imagination in a way that discursive prose does not. And we'll talk about that this evening. Right now, what I want to focus on is this. I want to talk about how a poem means. That is to say, how it conveys meaning. And I'm going to suggest that a poem, if it's well written, if it's well crafted, the whole point of poetry is to convey meaning at multiple levels. First, and most obviously, poetry conveys meaning at what I'm going to call the discursive level. The same level at which prose would communicate. You sit down and read a letter from Aunt Matilda. It conveys meaning at the discursive level. You pick up the New York Times and read a news article. It conveys meaning at the discursive level. You don't know whether it's true or not, but it conveys meaning nonetheless. Okay, at the discursive level, there is meaning being conveyed in most poetry, although in some poetry, there is such a shift toward other levels of meaning that the discursive level is abandoned almost altogether. But that's not the case typically in hymnody. Second level is what I'm going to call the suggestive level. At the discursive level, we ask, what does the poet say? At the suggestive level, we ask, what does he say without saying it? What are the connotations of what he says? What is he evoking? You remember last night, we did these comparisons, you know, girl, maiden, wench. And we had a fourth one. Suppose we throw in there damsel, which means girl. But it means more than girl, doesn't it? When a knight rescues a damsel in distress, this is not the same thing as just rescuing a girl in trouble. Or, okay, here's one. Would you rather have people say that you are asleep, that you are slumbering, or that you are in a stupor? The words mean sleep, slumber, and stupor are dictionary synonyms, right? But the word you choose says more than you're actually saying. There's something going on under the surface that suggests more than you're actually saying on the surface. I mean, most visible, most obvious characteristics of English poetry? Rhyme. Okay, now you don't have to have rhyme in order to have a poem. But probably a majority of poetry in English, at least since Shakespeare, has rhymed. When you insert rhymes, you are to some greater or lesser degree controlling meaning, because rhymes chime in different ways. If you end every line with an E rhyme, what effect is that going to have on you? Well, by the time you've piled up very many of those, it's like scraping fingernails on a blackboard. E, 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 E. Okay? In fact, if you overdo any rhyme, it gets to be that way. If you write a poem that's all full of moons and junes, okay, people are going to say this is sophomoric and sentimental. Because just the way the words chime, just the way the rhymes connect, creates some kind of a sensation that translates into emotion. And when we're dealing with poetry, it's all about the emotion. Okay? It's not that the emotion is what we're singing about. In fact, it shouldn't be. We shouldn't be looking at the emotion. We should be looking at the doctrine. But the emotion comes out of it by way of response to the doctrine. And if your rhymes are working against the meaning of what you're trying to do, it's going to undercut the whole thing that you're attempting to accomplish. Rhythm, and especially meter. Again, you don't necessarily have to have meter in order to have rhythm, but in English poetry, we very commonly do have meter. The great majority of English poems have meter of one kind or another. Many more poems have meter than have rhyme. You realize, meter, by the way, works differently in English than it works in other languages. In other languages, in Romance languages, for example, in Old Latin, in Modern French, meter isn't geared so much to accented versus unaccented syllables. Because in an inflected language, your accent can shift around to different places in the word. So they gear meter to short versus long syllables. Even when you're dealing with a single syllable, some syllables are going to be shorter, other syllables are going to be longer. Me, that's a short syllable. B, that's a short syllable. Bet, that's a slightly longer syllable. Bent, that's a much longer syllable. Spent, there's even a longer syllable. So in most languages that use meter, the meter and the accent, the meter is structured around short, long correspondences. Now, in English, we don't think in terms of short and long syllables usually, although it definitely has an effect on the way a poetic line works. If you're a poet, you have to pay attention to short and long syllables, to the way these syllables sound and to what they do. If you have a lot of L's in your poetry, it's going to make the line labor. Okay? Whereas, if you're using a lot of S's, it makes it zip right along. Typically, we use 4 meters in English poetry, and I hope, again, some of you, I'm insulting your intelligence. I know that in advance. I apologize in advance. We use anapests, dactyls, eons, and trochees. Anapests, da-da-da. Dactyls, da-da-da. Eons, da-da. And trochees, da-da. The accent scheme that you choose is going to have an effect on the meaning of what you're doing. Okay, if you choose anapests or dactyls, there is going to be the tendency for your production to have a much more lilting kind of flow that's going to lend itself, well, to a couple of different things. It could lend itself to narrative if you had long lines. If you have short lines, it tends to lend itself to the comedic. Anapests, dactyls, both tend to lend themselves to the comedic. It's no accident, for example, that limericks employ anapestic rhythm. Or that double dactyls, well, as the name would imply, employ dactylic rhythm. If you don't know what a double dactyl is, Google double dactyl sometime. You'll have fun with them, okay? They're a really fun kind of comic verse. Eoms and troches tend to lend themselves to more sober consideration. And again, I'm not saying that you could never use an anapest or a dactyl to say something serious. There are ways of doing it, but you've got to know what you're doing if you're going to do it. And I'm not saying there's never a time when you can use iambic or trochaic meter in order to do something comic. There are plenty of ways of doing that. But you've got to know what you're doing. And odds are that if you don't know what you're doing and you choose something anapestic, you're going to end up with something that at least tries to make a comedic point, whatever point you think you're making. Along with that goes line length. The shorter the line with an anapest or a dactyl, the greater the tendency for that line to be comedic. The longer the line with an eom or a trochee, the greater the tendency for that line to lend itself to serious consideration. And the stronger of the two, the more thoughtful of the two, is the iambic. The stronger of the two, the more vigorous and assertive of the two, is the trochee. So it's not an accident that most of our comic verse is written in anapestic or dactylic meter. It's not an accident that limericks are anapestic. It's not an accident that sonnets are iambic pentameter. You've got a thoughtful meter. You've got five poetic feet. That's long enough to develop a complete idea within a single line. So in a limerick, for example, you've got the short lines, you've got the anapestic rhythm, and you've got jingling rhymes that work together to make it almost impossible to say something serious. I can't imagine anybody ever writing a serious love poem using a chain of limericks. It couldn't be done. Even a genius, I think, wouldn't be able to do it. Once you're into limericks, you are, by virtue of the form itself, the way it works, the way it's structured, you are virtually committed to saying something funny. Even if you're not saying something funny, it's going to be funny by the time people hear it. It would be an interesting exercise for you sometime to go through a hymnal and to see if there are any limericks set to music in the hymnal. I can think of at least one composer, author, who has done that, who shall remain charitably unnamed for the moment. Okay, so you've got all of this stuff going on top of that. You have the whole business of imagery. Word pictures, analogies, metaphors, similes. And this is nothing like a complete list of all of the tools at a poet's disposal. But these are the kinds of things that a poet is going to be trying to use while he develops not only what he's trying to say, but what he's trying to say without saying it. What he wants to do is to reach into your affections and to trigger a response. He wants to get you to feel something about the object that is in view. Now, an awful lot of this is easier to illustrate than it is to lecture about. So, I've got an illustration for you here. I have for you a poem by John Donne entitled A Hymn to God the Father. John Donne is a member of a school of poets who lived during the 17th century who are called the metaphysical poets. They more or less trace themselves to Milton. Donne is probably the best known of them. George Herbert, Richard Crashaw, Andrew Marvell, Thomas Traherne, these are the metaphysical poets. Of them, by the way, the one that I enjoy the most is George Herbert. If you've never spent time in the poetry of George Herbert, you are missing a treat. He has some wonderful, wonderful stuff. And when you read his poetry, start with The Altar. But today we're looking at Donne, since what he's given us here is avowedly a hymn. Now, granted, you don't know any music to this hymn, and that's one reason I chose it. There is music to it. There are churches that sing this. My guess is that none of your churches ever have, and that makes it a good choice because we want to evaluate the text without some melody running through your mind while you do it, okay? Let me just read the poem for you, A Hymn to God the Father by John Donne. Wilt thou forgive that sin where I begun, which is my sin, though it were done before? Wilt thou forgive those sins through which I run, and do run still, though still I do deplore? When thou hast done, thou hast not done, for I have more. Wilt thou forgive that sin by which I have won others to sin, and made my sin their door? Wilt thou forgive that sin which I did shun a year or two, but wallowed in a score? When thou hast done, thou hast not done, for I have more. I have a sin of fear, that when I have spun my last thread, I shall perish on the shore. Swear by thyself that at my death thy sun shall shine as he shines now and heretofore. And having done that, thou hast done. I fear no more. Let's talk about the discursive level. Just at the discursive level, what's the poet saying? What is Donne talking about? Forgiveness. What's the problem that he's dealing with? How much can God forgive? How much can God forgive? And so he starts naming his sins. In fact, this whole thing turns out to be a kind of a breviary of sin. Turns out to be a kind of a taxonomy of sin. Let's take it piece by piece here. Wilt thou forgive that sin where I begun, which is my sin, though it were done before? What kind of sin is he talking about here? Depravity. This is original sin. This is Adamic sin. By the way, what theory of imputation did Donne hold? You're sitting there wondering, what are you talking about? Okay. There are two theories concerning the imputation of original sin. There is federal headship, and there is the Augustinian theory, sometimes called natural or seminal headship. Federal headship says that there's no necessary connection between the sinner and Adam. Adam stood as the representative head, and whatever sin he committed was charged against his descendants. Natural headship says that Adam's descendants were, in some sense, in Adam committing the sin with him when he committed it. So they are rightly charged with the sin because, not personally or individually, but as undifferentiated humanity, they were there. Which theory does Donne hold? Which is my sin, though it were done before. That's not federal headship. That's natural headship. He's not just saying, this sin was charged to me. He's saying, it's my sin. I did it. Okay, so what you're dealing with here, you're dealing with a man who understands his theology. He was, by the way, a pastor and theologian of the Church of England. He came to faith rather late in life, having lived colorfully. And his early poetry reflects a lot of that colorful living. Here, obviously he's writing as a regenerate man, but he's dealing with a theological question. What sin can God forgive? So he starts with original sin. Now he goes to this. Wilt thou forgive those sins through which I run and do run still, though still I do deplore? What sins is he talking about here? Yeah. The sins that he commits every day. Like, who doesn't commit sins? Even as a saved person. I know, if you're Wesleyan, maybe you don't commit sins anymore, you just make mistakes. Leaving that aside, Dunn is admitting here, look, I'm still committing sins. Can you still, I deplore these sins, I hate them, but every day I find myself running through some sins. Can you forgive those? When thou hast done, thou hast not done, he says, for I have more. Well, okay, done. What more do you have? Wilt thou forgive that sin by which I've won others to sin and made my sin their door? What kind of sin is he talking about here? Yeah, we'd call it stumbling block, sin of example. He's not only committed a sin, but he has led others into sin. Wilt thou forgive that sin which I did shun a year or two, but wallowed in a score? What kind of sin is he discussing here? Excuse me? I kept on committing these. Well, actually, it's not clear whether I'm not committing them now, but I used to for a long time, or I managed to avoid these for a while, but they came back, and I've been committing them for a long time. But either way, it comes out essentially the same kind of sin. It's habitual. It's what some would call addiction. I don't like that term when it's applied to the Christian life. I think a better term is enslavement. He's talking about sins that enslave. He's talking about idolatries. Okay? Can you forgive those? He asks. When thou hast done, thou hast not done. For I have more. I have a sin of fear that when I have spun my last thread, I shall perish on the shore. What sin is he talking about here? Unbelief. Unbelief. Here's my sin. I'm not sure I can trust you. And it's interesting that he acknowledges it's a sin, but he still names it. Can I really trust you? Can I really trust you to forgive me? I have a sin of fear that when I get to the end of my life, I'm going to find myself condemned anyway. What we would say is he's got a lack of assurance. Then he says, swear by thyself that at my death thy son shall shine as he shines now and heretofore. What's he asking for? Find a way of making a commitment that you can't go back on so that I can have confidence. That's what he's asking for. And having done that, thou hast done. I fear no more. Okay. Now, so far, we've been talking simply at the discursive level. Now I want to start to switch to the structural level. We've named a series of different kinds of sins. Original sin, daily sins, sins of example, enslaving sins, and distrust. Go back to the first couple, original sin and daily sin. Which of those do you suppose is the more serious form of sin? At least in Dunn's mind. Is it a bigger problem? Is it more serious in his mind that the guilt of original sin is imputed to him? Or is it a bigger problem that even as a saved man, he is still sinning? Well, that's the bigger problem, right? So we're moving from the lesser to the greater. Then sins of example. Wilt thou forgive that sin by which I've won others to sin and made my sin their door? I've caused others to stumble. I've led others into sin. Is that more or less serious than the fact that he himself continues to sin? More serious. Will you forgive that sin which I did shun a year or two, but wallowed in a score, an enslaving sin? Who knows what his may have been? Maybe he was an inveterate alcoholic. He was a drunkard and hated it. You know, maybe he was enslaved to pornography. I don't know if they even had that in the 17th century. I guess they must have in one form or another. Maybe he had an addiction to temper. He was just a furious tyrant all the time. I don't know what his enslaving sin may have been, but something that he struggled against and just could not seem to get out of. Is that a more or less serious matter than the sin of example? No, more serious. 20 years and you can't get out of this thing? You detect the pattern? So he goes along all the way. He's starting with the less serious. Can you forgive this? Okay then, can you forgive this? Okay then, can you forgive this? Really then, can you forgive this? What's the one that he ends up with? What does he think is the gravest sin of them all? Disbelief. Distrust. What is it that makes distrust so much worse than anything we've seen up to this point? Yeah. All these other sins, what are they sins against? They're sins against God's law. Distrust, what does that attack? It attacks God's very character. You're calling into question the trustworthiness of God Himself. Do you see what Dunn is doing here? He's bringing us up. The whole hymn is calculated to bring us to this point to deal with the ultimate sin, and the ultimate sin is distrust. By the way, what does that do to the way we usually think about the gravity of our sins? It sort of turns it all on its head, doesn't it? If somebody lacks assurance, do we typically regard that as a grave sin? Well, especially in churches where we tell four-year-olds to ask Jesus into your heart and you'll be saved, lack of assurance becomes par for the course. Probably it ought to. For Dunn, this was the worst thing he could think of. This is the worst thing I can do against God. Distrust. And so he's asking for assurance. And there's only one kind of assurance that will do. Swear by thyself that at my death thy sun shall shine as he shines now and heretofore. What will satisfy Dunn if God swears by himself? Does that resemble anything you've heard in Scripture? In fact, does it resemble anything we sang this morning? Yeah, in the God of Abram praise. Why is it such a serious matter for God to swear by himself? There's nothing greater by which he can swear. This, for God, is the irrevocable oath when he swears by himself. And of course, Dunn is calling to mind here the fact that God actually has sworn by himself. And having done that, thou hast done. Which brings us back to the little refrain at the end of each stanza. Who's writing the poem? Done. When thou hast done, thou hast not done. You catch the double entendre there? That's what we call a pun, right? And he's playing it to the hilt. When thou hast done, thou hast not done, for I have more. Not just saying you haven't finished. He's saying you haven't got me yet. When thou hast done, thou hast not done, for I have more. And then the final stanza. And having done that, thou hast done. I fear no more. Problem solved, right? He's saying more than he's saying. There's more going on than you're catching at the merely discursive level. In fact, go back through and look at some of the imagery that he incorporates here. Wilt thou forgive that sin which I did shun a year or two, but wallowed in a score? There's a word picture in that couplet. How is Dunn depicting himself? He's a pig in the slop. I have a sin of fear that when I've spun my last thread, I shall perish on the shore. How is he depicting himself in that couplet? He's a spider dangling from a thread. Are these flattering images? Not precisely, are they? He's deliberately adopting them. And he's not coming out and saying, in view of the sins that I've committed, I feel like a real pig. I feel like a loathsome spider. He's not saying that. What he's doing is using language that suggests it without saying it. And this is important in poetry. What you can suggest has more power than what you actually say. Because when the mind fills in what is suggested, it's the receiver's mind that's doing the work, which means the reader, the receiver, the listener is actually being engaged in the act of completing this. So the idea is, and what Dunn is trying to do, is not only to say, I'm a pig for doing this. He's trying to get you to feel like a pig for doing this as well. He's not only saying, I am a loathsome spider because of my lack of faith. He's trying to get us to feel like I'm loathsome because of my lack of faith. He's trying to get a response out of us. And by the way, you don't necessarily have to be aware of the devices. You don't have to be aware of what he's doing for it to work. Your mind is still going to be operating on this text. So we've gone way beyond the discursive here. We got into the structural, which brought us to the suggestive. We've been looking at imagery. We've been looking at, you know, the puns that he uses. And by the way, his name is not the only pun in the text. You know, look down in this last stanza. Swear by thyself that at my death thy son shall shine as he shines now and heretofore. What's the pun that he's using there? Exactly. Which, in the 17th century, you could actually spell either one, S-O-N-N-E. So, what son is he talking about? Well, obviously he's talking about the Son of God, but there's a metaphor here. There's an implied comparison that the Son of God is like the beaming sun of the heavens who is shining radiantly now, but what's going to happen then? Swear by thyself that just like your son has beamed with favor upon me in the past, and he's doing it now, swear by thyself that at the moment when I perish on the shore, he's going to be beaming with favor in the same way. Okay, that pun works right into the text. There's a word picture, there's a pun. But so far, we've skipped over the whole business of rhyme and meter. Look at the kind of rhymes that he uses. Begun, before, run, deplore. One, door, shun, score. Spun, shore, sun, heretofore. Just play with the sounds of the words. How do these words chime? Do they jingle? Do they tinkle?
They toll.
They toll. That's a very good word for it. There is a fullness and a richness. It's very much like a bell tolling at the end of every line. They are rounded syllables that sort of emerge in fullness. He's choosing his rhymes very carefully here. And he's also choosing his rhythm very carefully. And he's extremely careful in how he controls his rhythm. What's his overall meter? Leaving aside the refrain at the end of each stanza, what's his meter? Okay, it's iambic meter. How long is it? Pentameter. Which is kind of the gold standard. It's short enough that people don't get lost in a long line, but it's long enough that each line develops a good, discrete thought. Wilt thou forgive that sin where I begun, which is my sin, though it were done before? Wilt thou forgive those sins through which I run, and do run still, though still I do deplore? Wilt thou forgive that sin by which... And then notice here, he could have used just a standard abbreviation, I've, but he lengthens it a little bit. Not enough to break the meter, but enough to make it hiccup right there. By which I have won. And then in the next line, the natural accents of these words shift. By which I've won others to sin and made my sin their door. Why do you suppose he shifts that accent right there? Yeah. He's a stumbling block. And you stumble in the meter at that point. And he may not be thinking about the word stumbling block, but clearly he wants you to understand that in the development of what he's talking about, something is changing here. We've reached a sort of a turning point in the conversation, and it gets even more pronounced when you come into the third stanza. Notice, back in the second stanza, first line, how he abbreviates I have. Now come down to the third stanza and look at what he does there. Do you see it? I have a sin of fear that when I have spun, what's he done to his pentameter? He's broken it. Here we've got just this. This isn't just a lengthened syllable or something like that. It's a fractured meter. We've got 11. We no longer have 5 poetic feet, 10 syllables. We've got an extra syllable thrown in. He's fractured the entire meter. Why? Why would he do that here? This is the worst sin. This is the thing that really breaks it, so to speak, or that breaks him, or that breaks his relationship to God. The idea of brokenness is built into this line. And then, as you come down to his appeal, okay, I have a sin of fear that when I have spun my last thread, you've still got fractured accents there. Okay, you're not back in meter yet. I shall perish on the shore. And then you hit this. Swear by thyself. Now, you ought to read that in meter. Swear by thyself that at my death thy son. But nobody would read those words that way. You've got to strongly accent the word swear just by virtue of the kind of syllable it is. And the accent of the meter wants to lead you to accent by. In French, they've got an accent
or a meter that is called a spondee.
Anybody here speak French? Anybody know what a spondee is? What's a spondee?
A spondee is where you have two accented syllables coming right together. Or in French, it would be two long syllables coming right together. Okay? What he's done here in English is the equivalent of a double spondee. All four of these syllables in a row really get accented. Swear by thyself.
You suppose that's an accident?
Nah, this guy knows what he's doing. This man has control of his language. He knows what he's doing. He knows how to get it done. This is no accent here. Swear by thyself that at my death thy son shall shine as he shines now and heretofore. Okay? You've got your double spondee. And then he goes back into his meter again. Why that kind of accent on those four words, those four syllables? This is the hinge. This is the pivot of the whole conversation. Everything depends on this. Remember last night we talked about Asaph, emphasizing a line by alliterating every word? Well, here, Dunn is emphasizing not by underlining or by italicizing, but by structuring the accents so that you end up departing from the normal meter of the piece and emphasizing each of these four syllables. You can't avoid emphasizing them. Swear by thyself. This is the heart of everything. This is what he wants us to see here. Has God sworn by himself? Absolutely. And if God has sworn by himself, what's the result? Having done that, thou hast done. I fear no more. You see, there's the surface discursive meaning, which is already theologically rich. The moment you start to go below the surface, beneath the surface, what you discover is that you have levels and layers of meaning that create an entire web and texture. And it's that entire web and texture that constitutes, so to speak, the little world that Dunn creates. And he invites us into this world, and through the windows of this world, he invites us to look at our sin and God's oath and to see it in a way that we've never seen it before. And he doesn't just want us to understand intellectually. He wants us to respond effectively. What time am I done, by the way? Okay. For a moment, I was worried that I'd gone over time. Maybe I have, and you're just too kind to point it out to me. I don't know. Okay. Good hymn, bad hymn. I'm going to say this is a really good hymn. Now, it may not be one that you'd want to sing congregationally. It may be too unfamiliar. There may be reasons that you wouldn't choose to sing it congregationally. But whether that's the case or not, this is a good hymn. It's a good poem. It is well constructed. The author knows what he's trying to do. He knows exactly how he has to do it, and he does it well, so that he not only teaches us the doctrine, but he gets us to respond the way that we ought to respond. So, good hymn. We need to learn to evaluate all of our hymnody the same way. Can we pray? Father, we rejoice that you have sworn by yourself. Without your oath, without your covenant, without the blood of Jesus, we would be without hope. We would be loathsome spiders dying on the shore. Father, thank you for your goodness to us, for your mercy and grace. And thank you for a man who, perhaps even because of the debauchery of his earlier life, understood so clearly the depth of your mercy and the magnificence of your grace. And thank you that you have used him to lead us into understanding in a fresh and deeper way what you have done for us. We rejoice this morning. We ask you for wisdom and help as we minister. In Jesus' name, amen.